From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. On this special Pledge Drive edition of the show, we are honoring Sunshine Week. It's a week dedicated to government transparency and the work of journalists who hold government accountable for that transparency. And that includes my colleagues here at WHQR and the journalists we work with at WECT and Port City Daily. And later on the show, we'll hear from Kelly Kinoyer as she sits down with Brenna Flanagan from Port City Daily and Zach Solon from WECT as they took a deep dive into the world of domestic violence protective orders. And Rachel Keith and I will talk about a recent new policy at the school board that seems to run afoul, at the very least, of the spirit of public records law here in North Carolina. But first up, I'm sitting down with Rachel and Peter Castaño from Port City Daily to talk about their joint project looking at the world of warrants. Now, warrants are public records, except when they're not. And as we found out, that's not the only potential source of confusion. All right, I'm here with my colleagues Rachel Keith and Peter Castaño from Port City Daily. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So you've spent the last couple weeks looking into the world of warrants. And here we're not talking about search warrants as much as we are just the classic warrant, as in there is a warrant out for your arrest. And this was done, as we said, in conjunction with Sunshine Week. So from your point of view, what was the goal of this project? Rachel, I'll start with you.
Peter and I focused on outstanding warrants. So we asked police departments and sheriff's offices in the counties of New Hanover, Brunswick, Pender, Bladen, and Columbus, and the cities of Wilmington and Leland. So we wanted to understand what the quantity was and if we could get those public records from these law enforcement agencies.
Yeah, and we got kind of conflicting responses from various entities, and it was a bit of a wild goose chase tracking down who exactly the authority figure or which government body could give us that information. We had Amanda Prince of Columbus County tell us that the warrants would not be public records and could kind of be given at the discretion of various law enforcement agencies, and versus the Court of Clerks telling us that we would have to reach out to AOC for those documents. So it was a bit of a confusing ordeal.
You guys had a little bit of ping pong where the courts were telling you to speak to the state level and the state level was telling you to look at the local level.
That's right. And you reached out to Jeff Welty of the UNC School of Government, and he basically said what we realized was that the paper trail for outstanding warrants, that is not technically a public record, but it does become a public record when the defendant has been arrested. So when the warrant has been served and the public is able to access that information.
Yeah, and you guys basically were able to, you know, lay out how this, a lot of what we're talking about here is in kind of a gray area, because there are, you know, there are things that are absolutely not a public record, you know, things like personnel records or a sealed court document. And then there are things that are very clearly a public record. If a journalist or really anyone asks the government, they have to give it to you. And then there are things that aren't sealed but aren't mandated as public records. So, for example, the government can give it to you, but it's sort of up to their discretion. And one of the examples we found was the Winston-Salem Police Department actually has an online database that has active warrants. So these are people that have not been served with these warrants yet. These are just basically outstanding warrants that, you know, anyone can go and just look at this database and see, you know, who the Winston-Salem Police Department is looking for.
Yeah, that's right. And it's pretty interesting, when we're talking to these law enforcement agencies, they basically, you know, started with paper warrants, right? And then they went to their own records management system. And then they went to something called NC Aware. And that is what Winston-Salem Police Department uses. And so I reached out to the public information officer there, and she said this gets updated weekly, and it was implemented in 2007. And she said, quote, the decision was made by now retired employees. And she added that no one in the department, in the police department, felt comfortable speaking on the matter. So that was pretty interesting. And then so we put it to Welty about this site, and he said that it's possible that there are formal or informal channels for sharing information about wanted persons, But, you know, the lay of the land, like you said, changes depending on what the department feels is necessary to put out to the public.
I did think it was interesting. It almost felt like the current Winston-Salem Police Department administration was not thrilled that this database exists, and yet it exists for some reason. But it is a good example. I mean, I can think of lots of other places, especially in the criminal justice system, where there's discretionary release. For example, when someone gets arrested, there's an incident report. And most law enforcement agencies have some kind of P2C or, you know, police to citizen online where you can go up. And if you know the name of the person or you know the time and date of the incident, you can go and pull up the cover sheet of it. But what you don't see online most of the time is the officer's narrative. So the officers were sort of write down a first-person narrative of what they saw when they were there. That is not a sealed document, but it's not considered a public document. So there's been times when I have maybe been in a good phase with a law enforcement agency where we're having a good working relationship and they were willing to share that with us, and other times when they were not.
Right.
All right. So moving on, part of the story of warrants and how they're shared and how this whole system works has to do with e-warrants and what's called e-courts, which is part of North Carolina's attempt to enter the 21st century when it comes to record management. As you mentioned, Rachel, there was a time where there were just rows and rows of filing cabinets full of warrants in alphabetical order. And if you wanted to know if someone had a warrant out for them, well, you got your fingers and you started walking across
That's
the tops
right.
of those files. But the state has tried to start digitizing and indexing these. And Peter, this is part that you looked into. This is not going great.
That's right. It's been a process that's definitely faced some controversies. Since 2019, when the AOC signed a $100 million contract with Texas-based software firm Tyler Technologies to develop that e-court system and slowly roll it out over about 5 years in North Carolina, e-warrants preceded e-courts. It's been around for several years now, and it's applied in all 100 counties. However, e-courts is only in about 17 now, and it's estimated to be in about 50 by the end of the year, with New Hanover entering next year. And already, law enforcement stakeholders and all of those counties have expressed misgivings about this system, slowing down processes, technical errors on the interface between e-courts and e-warrants. But even on the non-e-courts applied counties, e-warrants has had issues with leading to multiple arrests because people, their warrant shows up again in the system and is now the subject of a class action lawsuit on behalf of all individuals in North Carolina who have been wrongfully detained because of that system.
Yeah, and I will add part of this Sunshine project that we did together was, okay, we can't get the record necessarily of the outstanding warrant, but could you give us the number? And so this is how e-warrants comes in, is that we had the Wilmington Police Department and New Hanover County, for example, say there are over 200. And when we asked them, okay, well, what's the actual number? They said that's where it stops. So you can only run, oh, okay, it's all over 200 and that's it. But then we have the town of Leland, for example, could run, hey, we right now, as of March 8th, we have 25 outstanding warrants. And what they did was did it granularly. They had, for example, 12 larcenies out on arrest, people wanted for those, 2 assaults, 5 fraud. But it looks like with these larger departments, it's not showing up that granular, or according to them, they couldn't give us that information.
So part of the reason we looked at this is we wanted to know, can the public find out how many unserved warrants there are? Because there are some legitimate concerns. We have seen time and again, most recently there was a very tragic case, there was a killing on in Murrayville, where after the suspect was arrested, it became public knowledge that there were other active warrants for this person. And so a concern the public always has is, are there people out there right now who could be arrested under an existing warrant, and would that prevent future acts of violence? And so getting a sense of how many unserved warrants, and more specifically, what those warrants are out there for, would be important. But you guys found that this is actually really difficult and really inconsistent. Like you said, Rachel, Leland was able to give you some pretty granular data, whereas other places just sort of said, A, it's not a public record, or B, we don't have details on that.
That's right.
Yeah, and ultimately, we had multiple people direct us to the clerk of the Superior Court, who then told us that we needed to request that kind of detailed report with the quantity of those warrants from the administrative office of the courts. They emailed us back yesterday and said to get that from the clerk of the Superior Court. So bounced us back and forth. And the AOC has not responded to repeated requests for comment over the past week.
There was certainly a kind of catch-22 flavor to some of this, I have to say. As someone who's observing and watching you guys from the benches, watching you guys go around and around with these guys, the last thing I wanted to say is that not all warrants are the same. And in North Carolina, there's another layer of complexity in that citizens can take out warrants. Some of these are very serious. I don't want to disparage that. You know, people who have been defrauded or assaulted can go to a magistrate and say, this person, you know, did X, Y, and Z to me. I would like to take a warrant out against them. And that warrant then joins this list of unserved warrants. But some of them can be quite frivolous. I've heard, at least on background, from law enforcement officers. And so you guys at least got some sense from some of our local law enforcement agencies that there is an attempt to kind of prioritize more serious outstanding warrants. So even though we're saying, yes, there is a large number of them, hopefully law enforcement is looking at the most egregious crimes here, or the most egregious alleged crimes.
And that's what Lieutenant Brewer of New Hanover County Sheriff's Office told us, that it's common sense which ones go to the top and which ones, you know, are not. For example, there's a warrant out for arrest for trespassing. And, you know, are you going to prioritize that over something more serious? But then we have what Peter has mentioned, that there's a lawsuit that this can also work in a different way, that you could have served your time, or the courts had processed you through, but somebody else would pull it up and say, no, we got to arrest this person because it's showing up in e-warrants. And that's what this suit is about as well. So it's a complicated web here.
And that, absolutely. And something very interesting, we spoke with Mr. Abraham Rupertschul of Tin Fulton, the civil rights attorney involved in that class action lawsuit. And he mentioned, you know, he noted that there have been these high profile instances of mishaps with e-warrants. However, how many are going under the radar? You know, how many do we know or don't know about that could be occurring frequently?
And I believe one of the experts you spoke to also told us that in the coming year, in 2025, New Hanover County's court system will, at least on paper, will be entering the e-court system. For years, we've all reported here locally. We've all gone down to the courthouse and pulled physical court filings. It is not the most technologically advanced system, but it does work. I've never really had a problem pulling a court file. But we were given kind of a grim prognosis on what we might be in store for.
We were, yeah. I believe he said it would be a disaster potentially. But yeah, multiple counties, stakeholders within the justice system have described serious delays. I mean, and mathematically less amounts of cases that they can actually follow through on. There's the learning curve of understanding how to apply the software and everything, but then delays and technical difficulties as well.
Well, that could be a 2025 Sunshine Week story. But for now, Rachel Keith and Peter Castagna, thank you guys so much.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be back in a moment with Kelly Knoyer as she sits down with Brenna Flanagan from Port City Daily and Zach Solon from WECT to talk more about our Sunshine Week investigative work. You're listening to The Newsroom. And if you want to support more investigative reporting like this, here's how. Head to WHQR.org and make your pledge of support online. It's crucially important. It's support from people like you that makes up over half of the funding that powers the reporting here from the WHQR newsroom, that makes the newsroom the show possible. Every year, year after year, support from people like you has allowed us to dig deeper, to take deep dives, to really peel back the layers of complicated stories and get into it in a way that we just wouldn't be able to if we didn't have your support. So that's why we're asking you to go to WHQR.org, make your pledge of support, and let reporters like me and Rachel keep doing what we love doing and what we feel like is the best way for us to serve the community.
Yeah, I have been so excited about the feedback I've gotten about the newsroom, especially about the following that is around the turnaround task force. So we've done a bunch of shows on that, Ben, you and I, about what they're talking about, how to fix some of the lowest performing schools in the county. And I'm going to these meetings every 3 months or so. There's a lot of voices. We have the principals roundtable, the teachers. I was just at a parent one. People are hungry to talk about these ideas on how to turn these schools around. And we also get into poverty, and we get into ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. We've done that unpacking on the newsroom. So this work is so important to us and to the community, because again, WHQR listeners aren't just a quick 2 minute, give me the summary. It's okay, let's think about this. What are the ideas? What are the pitfalls? What are the positives? Nothing's ideal. How do we work through these issues? So if you value that type of work, continue to support us by going to WHQR.org and clicking on that donate button for the spring pledge drive.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, you and I both have colleagues in the digital media world and the TV news world. For this show, we worked with Zach Solon from WECT. He's a great reporter. We have both worked with Michael Pratz, formerly of Port City Daily, and who used to work for WECT. He's in Charlotte now. And I've had these conversations with our friends in TV news, and it's just, man, it's really difficult. And they do a great job of distilling these complicated issues the best they can, but they really only have 4 minutes at most. And when it comes to something like, say, the turnaround task force, where it's, you know, a dozen or so people having complicated conversations that require backstory, that require unpacking, that are some heady concepts. I mean, the conversation will begin with, you know, talking about ACEs, and then you've got to stop and explain what ACEs are, you know, those adverse childhood experiences that requires a whole other episode of the newsroom to unpack. And so having this format allows us to take you there, take you to that conversation, put you in the middle of it, give you the tools and the context you need to understand it, to really wrap your head around some of the most important issues in our community at this time. And that's because of you. And we're so grateful. It's just an incredible honor to be able to do this. But we do need your support. So that's why we're asking you to head to WHQR.org. Keep powering our reporting. Keep powering the show. Keep powering our partnerships with reporters at places like Port City Daily and WECT and the Border Belt Independent and the Assembly and all the other people who have come to us and want to work with us, because they get a chance to, you know, sometimes get on these shows too. So again, we're grateful, but we do need your support.
Yeah, we need it now. Go to WHQR.org to make your pledge of support and any amount you think is appropriate to support WHQR Public Media. And I'm so proud to be part of this local news ecosystem. We've, like you said during the show, we've had collaborations with Port City Daily and WECT. We've had candidate forums with them for the past couple of years. We've all heard about local journalism across the country being in a tough spot and how important local journalism is to the health of our democracy. So we are talking to our fellow journalists and saying, let's team up. Let's do these things together. There's less of us, but we still have a big job to do. And that's why we have to come together certain times. We serve different niches, but there are certain times when it's really important. They know we're all here to hold our public officials accountable. So if you want to continue to support that work, go to WHQR.org.
That's right. You know, I've been in conversations with reporters and journalists all around the country. I've been to conferences. I'm in a Facebook group with, you know, journalists from my alma mater at Rutgers in New Jersey. And we have this conversation all the time. And I hear all the time that local journalism is dying. And I get to say, not on my watch, not in my town, but that's only because of your support. And we're so grateful for that. We just ask that you keep it up, because we want to keep doing this. And we thank you. Head to WHQR, make your pledge of support. If you've already done it and you're listening to this podcast, then you're off the hook. And we just say thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the newsroom. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for joining us for this special pledge drive edition of The Newsroom, where we are honoring Sunshine Week, which is all about government transparency and the work of journalists to ensure that transparency. Up now, my colleague Kelly Kinoyer talks to reporters from WECT and Port City Daily about exactly that kind of work.
All right, I am here with Brenna Flanagan from Port City Daily and Zach Solon from WECT. Thank you both for joining me for this conversation on domestic violence protection orders.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us, Kelly.
So first of all, I just want to ask each of you, since you did the research for this part of the story, what are domestic violence protection orders and how do they work?
So the state of North Carolina, the court system, lays it out pretty well. If anyone feels as though they are a victim of domestic violence, threatened by domestic violence, someone you're in a relationship with, it could be a family member, someone you share a child with, you have the right as a citizen to file a domestic violence protection order against them. It doesn't cost anything to do. You go to the courthouse, you get it filed. But then as we found, whether or not that moves forward and is actually enforced, that differs by each judge, each case, each county.
So in terms of the actual process, it's a little bit complicated. I know, first of all, somebody will go, who is filing one of these orders, will go to the courthouse, they'll ask for a protection order, and then they immediately go before a judge that same day, right?
Correct. It's called an ex parte hearing, and the first thing that the judge will do is kind of go over, and what they're looking for, and this is coming straight from the court's website, is what domestic violence is being alleged, what the relationship with the person is, and then the judge will decide whether or not the warrant for not it's not a warrant for arrest because these are civil cases, right? So it's whether or not the domestic violence protective order be served. In that instance, it goes to the sheriff's office to be served, and then there would be another court date. That would be a more formal hearing where either the plaintiff who is seeking the order of protection and the defendant would meet and either agree, or if there's a disagreement, the judge would pretty much hold the trial on the spot or at a later date and decide how to enforce that.
So we sought some data from different jurisdictions in the Cape Fear region. I looked at data in New Hanover County. We also got data from Brunswick and Pender counties. And interestingly, when I talked to Lieutenant Brewer, he said these ex parte orders, when they are ordered, they are served that day or within 10 days. He said by law, it has to be within 10 days. And we don't have clear data about whether they all do get served in New Hanover County, but we did get that for Brunswick County, right, Brenna?
Yes, we did from Brunswick County. By far, they gave us the most extensive data that we asked for. And so in Brunswick County, the filings per capita, so that's per 1,000 people, was 4.3. And out of that, how many that are actually served are 1.65 per 1,000 people. And their dismissal rate ends up around 61%. So that's over half that get dismissed in Brunswick County. So very interesting there.
That was significantly higher than New Hanover
yes.
County.
Mm-hmm.
It was 33% in New Hanover. So we are not sure exactly why the differences are there, frankly, mm-hmm. because we don't have granular data about which judges are denying these orders mm-hmm. or saying yes to them. So that's some of the information that we don't have and we kind of wish we had.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it all comes down to, and we've learned this through this public records process, is we've gotten different responses from different counties and different agencies that we've reached out to. And it doesn't seem like there's any clear database of where these orders are, where they're served, and when they're not. Pender County, for example, we requested the information from, and they gave us a list of all the domestic violence protective orders over the past year, year and a half at this point, and basically, were they served, and if they weren't served, was there an attempt? But we didn't get any information on how many had been dismissed mm-hmm. or anything like that. We requested that from the sheriff's office.
Interesting. I just want to lay out a little bit more information here. I interviewed Judge J.H. Korpening about this process, and he said that there are a lot of reasons why some of these orders can be dismissed. It could be that that judge that day just didn't think that person had a valid argument. It could be that they didn't provide enough information. And often after that initial hearing, the second hearing where that person is facing their abuser, sometimes they don't show up out of fear, or they ask for it to be dismissed for various personal reasons, whether they are financially reliant on their abuser. There are a lot of different reasons that it can end up dismissed. So looking at the individual case files is kind of the only way to really know what's going on in some of these cases.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think something that we've learned just through going through the process of this, and obviously the rate in some of these counties that are dismissed, if that's indicative of elsewhere, we're talking at minimum a third in New Hanover County, mm-hmm. right? So I think it really is something that you have to look at from, like you mentioned, a psychological perspective as to why a lot of these get dismissed by the person who's accusing them themselves, the plaintiffs themselves, because at the end of the day, it does come down to this is someone you know. You know, you can't just file a DVPO, as we've called it informally, against anybody. It has to be against a relative, an ex, someone you've had a relationship with that you need to get away from.
Yeah, definitely a lot of things can happen over time. Relationships can change and people can change their minds about things. And that really depends on how fast the sheriff's office can find these people to serve them the order. And we found, at least in Brunswick County, a lot of people could not be found by the sheriff's office, and those orders are not getting presented to those people, and that sort of slows down the process for these people seeking these orders.
What percentage of them weren't getting served?
I don't know that number exactly, but I would say maybe like a third are not finding these people.
And that's what's interesting about it is the court system lays out the process that the more formal hearing cannot move forward unless the defendant has been served, mm-hmm. right? So if you, it's kind of like you're stuck in limbo if they can't find the person, or, you know, who's to say if they're contacting them. One example that's actually laid out here on nccourts.gov is that if, you know, you are being bothered by someone receiving, you know, an excessive number of calls or texts per day, that's a reason you can file a domestic violence protective order. And that can happen, be something, that's what caught my eye, is that's something that can happen from out of town. So if somebody can't be found and they can't be served, they could still be, in a way, you know, abusing someone from a distance, and the judge can't hear that unless someone has been served. Now, it's different if they've been served and they don't show up, mm-hmm. then the judge can still hear it. But if they haven't been served, there's really no path forward. And as we've seen, that's happening in almost a third of cases,
yeah,
right?
Quite a lot.
Judge Korpening actually had a very specific example that was very similar to that of what evidence can qualify for one of these ex parte hearings.
The threat or the harm may have happened some time ago. She may have run. She may have come to Wilmington to get away. And then all of a sudden, she gets a text, found you. Well, does she feel like there's imminent serious risk or harm? Sure. The physical violence happened some time ago. It was just a text. But the text is what then lets her know that she's in danger. So I think that we have to look at it very carefully, not let our frustrations become bias, and keep open minds about what's her state of mind and where is she. Not would I be afraid, but is she afraid?
And so that text message can be seen as a threat in certain cases, but not necessarily in all of them. And having all of that evidence laid out is so key for being able to actually get these orders served. And you are often better served if you have an attorney present who can help you with that. And that can be a major barrier for a lot of people who are mm-hmm. facing domestic violence.
Absolutely. I mean, it doesn't require an attorney to file anything like that. It also doesn't cost anything. I've personally been to the courthouse myself just looking for records from the civil clerk's office. And I've heard people come up saying, hey, I'd like to file a domestic violence protective order. And it is a process that you have to go through, fill out a lot of things. But we've seen cases in the past where oftentimes these get dismissed fairly quickly, if they're even heard at all.
I do kind of want to talk about the process that we went through to get this data, because I think it's interesting, at least from a public record nerd perspective, which is a lot of journalists. Mm-hmm. I think it's everybody in this room right now. All of us sent the exact same request to all of these different counties, and the responses we got were drastically different.
Yes.
So, Brenna, can you start and explain what you got, since you got the most information of any of us?
Yes. So, like I said, Brunswick County was the most extensive data that we got. We asked for data from January 1st, 2023, to our current date, which was sort of the end of February. And out of all three, everyone had different dates. So we had to sort of parse that down to just 2023, which was, you know, a task in itself. But they broke it down between received, active, served, dismissed, returned, and expired, which out of all three counties was the most extensive breakdown of these orders. And what's interesting about Brunswick County is that they only gave us 50 Bs, and those refer to domestic violence protective orders between intimate partners, so people that you're living with, relationships, that sort of thing. 50 C's, the other counties gave us that information as well. Those are for people that you don't know, that may be stalking you, but you don't really have a relationship with this person. So Brunswick County only gave us 50 B's, but the other counties gave us 50 C's, and sometimes those were mixed up together. They didn't give us a breakdown of the difference between them. So that was also an interesting part of the data as well.
You were actually given individual case numbers for every mm-hmm. case as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's way more granular than what I got from New Hanover County.
Yes.
Which was interesting because I have a prior relationship in my professional life with Jerry Brewer, who's the lieutenant in charge of dealing with the press. So whenever we send him an email, we send him a text message to have him check his email. And then he will call us to talk through the whole conversation. Oh, what are you looking for exactly? And in this case, he called me and said, this is a court record, but just to help you out, I'm going to give you what I can. So he gave me just the bare stats of what domestic violence protective orders were received in 2023, which were considered valid and which were denied or had hearings scheduled. And then I later asked for additional years, and he provided back to 2018. So it was less information, but it was more of a conversation. And that can be really common in cities that are used to dealing with a lot of the press.
I think that's true, too. I mean, that's just something that we experience day to day in our time as journalists, that it depends on relationships and whatnot. But at the end of the day, a public record is a public record. And what we got from Pender County, I think, indicates this is a document that's been created by the sheriff's office. Whether or not it was created because of our request, you can kind of tell because we requested from January of 2023 to February of 2024. You could see that the, you know, issue date they gave us starts January 18th of 2023. They gave us the case number, but then they basically only gave us whether or not the DVPO was served. It says successful or unsuccessful, and if so, when was it served? And if not, what was the reason it wasn't served? And most of them was that they were unable to locate the defendant before the court date. And that's something that we've, you know, talked about already, that that is something that can delay a lot of these hearings from going to court. A couple of examples here, you see one moved to Columbus County, moved to other counties, but still a good chunk of these were not served. But a lot of them were, too. I think, Brenna, you know, you went through the data and everything, but we saw just from Pender County 465 over the last year and 2 months.
And that's the reason we do these Sunshine Week requests to a bunch of different government agencies, so that we can kind of do this stress test and see whether they're following the letter of the law at the state level and whether they're going to do more for us than the law requires or do less than the law requires. So that's kind of what we were testing out here. I don't think it, given the letter of the law, that it was wrong for them to say this is a court document, not a document owned by the sheriff's deputies, but they have the option to provide that information if they so choose, because they do have those records. So in this case, we saw a lot of different visions of what that meant.
Absolutely. And then even Columbus County, we were told just to go through the clerk of court's office for each county, that the county is not the keeper of court records. But as we see, plenty of counties do keep a log of the domestic violence protective orders that they've served, yet to serve, why they couldn't serve them. And I think it's interesting to see. We want to also mention we reached out to Bladen County. We were told their county attorney is still working on the request. We'll have to wait and see what they get back to us.
Well, Zach and Brenna, thank you so much for coming into the studio today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we need to take one more quick break for today's show. But when we come back, my colleague Rachel Keith will be here again as we unpack a new policy from the New Hanover County School Board that, frankly, is not in keeping with the spirit of Sunshine Week. I'm Ben Schuckman. You're listening to The Newsroom. And if you want to support this show and my colleagues, my fellow reporters here at WHQR and the station as a whole, here's how.
Go to the website whqr.org and click the donate link. Also, if you're calling between the hours of 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. on a weekday in the first couple of days of the new week, you can call 910-343-1138 to give to WHQR. It's support from listeners like you that make it possible for us to bring you the newsroom every week or two, and we're thrilled to do it.
That's right, Kelly. For the last 3 years and change, we have been doing this show, and it's one of the first things I talked about when I took the job here at WHQR, and it's one of the first things you and I talked about when you took the job a couple months later, and it was, you know, for journalists who often are working on deadlines and we're turning and burning and we're reporting on last night's meeting or some spot news that just happened, it is rare for journalists to get the opportunity, even once in a while, to be able to slow down and really dig into an issue, really investigate it, put it in context, give its backstory, peel the onion, basically. And we get to do it almost every week.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I love the newsroom for that reason, especially the episodes that we get to treat almost like an audio documentary. I don't get to do them all that often because we don't have all of the resources you could imagine in the newsroom. We have a pretty limited staff here. But when we get the chance and we are passionate about a specific topic, we get to really dig in and go in the weeds, interview everybody who touches that topic, and spend an entire hour telling you about what's going on in your community. And that's a really special thing. I don't think every public radio station lets a reporter like me take over a show like this. And so it's only because we have listeners like you who support it that we get to do the cool things that you like to listen to.
That's right. It's support from people like you listening right now that makes this possible, that we get to do this. We'd love to do more. We'd love to make The Newsroom a weekly show. We'd love to get some production staff so we can do those richer, more fully produced shows that really take you somewhere. But we love what we're doing right now, and we want to keep doing it, but we need your support. So that's why we're asking you to head over to whqr.org and make your pledge of support. Or maybe you're listening to this during the week. If it's still during our pledge drive, we hope you'll give us a call at 910-343-1138. Basically, the phones are open at 6 a.m. and they run till a little after 6 p.m. So if it's Monday, Tuesday, or maybe even Wednesday, just give us a call. If you're listening to the station, you'll know where we're at in the pledge drive. Kelly and I are recording this in the middle of the pledge drive. So right now, it's all we can see.
I do want to say the reason that you're hearing us talking about this now, when you're not used to hearing this detailed of a conversation about it during pledge drives, is that we are realizing that our listenership is changing their listening habits. We don't have people coming to the radio to hear about what we're doing very much anymore. So you might be downloading this as a podcast. Maybe you're hearing it on the web. That's why we're asking you, as somebody who relies on us for your local news, for the nuanced, interesting conversation that you get from WHQR, for the public records digging that we do in cooperation with other news stations in this community, we need your support to make that happen. And I know that you rely on us, just like we rely on you. So go to the web, whqr.org. We really do rely on you. It's 50% of our budget, which is so much. It's unimaginable coming from newspapers, which I did.
Yeah, I will say, you know, this particular show, I think, highlights something really important. And that's there are a lot of different ways to do news. And by that, I mean in a business sense, a lot of different business models. For a long time, I worked at Port City Daily. And that's why I'm so happy we still get to work with them and that we have such a good partnership with them. But they have a paywall. And they have advertisements, and that's how they fund the great journalism that they do over there. WECT doesn't have a paywall. They have ads on television and on the web. That's how they pay for it. We have underwriters, but we don't really we have no paywall at all. And so it's a little bit of a different model, and that's why we go to the community twice a year and ask for your support so we can keep doing this. But we really believe that when you support this newsroom, you know, we've been saying that, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats, which is a cliche, but it's true. I mean, when you support this newsroom, you're also supporting work like today's show, where we worked with Zach Solon from WECT and Brenna Flanagan and Peter Castagno from Port City Daily. And we're kind of taking your money and we're leveraging it to do even more. So we're pulling in partners. We're, you know, we're bringing in other journalists to go further, to dig deeper. And again, that's the kind of thing that you've made possible. So we're asking for your support. Head to whqr.org and make your pledge of support. Wherever you're listening to this from, take out your smartphone. If you can pull up whqr.org, you'll see that little donate button in the top right button. We're hoping you'll push it.
And tell them the newsroom sent you. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us for this special pledge drive edition of The Newsroom. I'm here with my colleague Rachel Keith again, who has also stuck around. Rachel, thanks for being here again.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're still talking about sunshine. We're still talking about transparency, but now we're talking about a specific policy that was recently passed by the New Hanover County School Board. This is policy 2320. Rachel, break down for us what is going on with this policy.
So this was passed in a 4-3 vote, and it outlines open meetings law. So that is a state law where the public gets to view our elected officials deliberating over public business. And what caught my eye about this particular policy was that in it, there is a line that now says that board members get to view public agenda files before the general public. And I was wondering where this came from. And it looks like in a February policy meeting, school board member Pat Bradford looks like she was taking somewhat of ownership over this provision.
The public then becomes access to everything we have, sits at our meetings and voices their opinion in our meeting. But then they might as well be elected officials, was kind of the gist of my thinking.
So that's school board member Pat Bradford talking about how she felt like as an elected official, it was their right, basically, to look at documents first. But people say stuff during meetings that aren't always completely articulate. So you followed up with Bradford to ask for any clarity or context. And what did she tell you?
Yes, she emailed back, quote, "In a group discussions, I think through things out loud to get feedback. It is a habit I'm learning not to do in our meetings. I frequently regret it. I do believe 48 hours is timely." And she there is referring to seeing, I think that would be a minimum time frame before when the board would view agenda files before they are posted to the public. And it is not nefarious. In reality, when board members first lay eyes on materials, we see some incompleteness or even slight inaccuracies. That extra time gives staff time to correct or add what is put out to the public so it is complete.
Okay, so before we unpack that in the context of what the actual law in North Carolina is with regards to public records, I want to hear from board member Stephanie Crabill. And this is earlier this month. This is a March 12th meeting where she was talking about this particular take on public records.
Coming back to another comment that one of our board members made is, we are elected officials. We deserve to have the information first. If people in the public want the information first, then they should run for office. I mean, that's the thought process behind this. So I'm just, I don't know why the public can't see it when we see it. When central office staff deems it appropriate for release, it's appropriate for release for everybody to look at.
And we even have at this same March 12th meeting, we have board member Stephanie Walker talking about this same issue that, hey, we're about to pass this where the board gets preference over the public and seeing these public files. And this is what she said.
And I'm worried that that's not enough notice for the public to prepare themselves for a meeting. And I also, again, I'm concerned with public records. If we get it, unless it's student or staff related, which is confidential, then the public has a right to see it.
And what board member Stephanie Walker is talking about here is there are some state laws and federal laws that protect students. FERPA, for example, which protects student privacy. And the state's personnel records, which gives you a really narrowly banded stuff about what you can learn about someone. But there's a pretty broad swath of stuff that is still public. And just because you mention an employee or mention a student doesn't automatically mean that you can't get those records. And in general, I can say, having covered the New Hanover County School Board for, you know, the better part of a decade now, 8 years, I can say I have yet to see, and I could be wrong, but I personally have yet to see an agenda item that had anything redacted in it. What we're talking about is a document that is going to be given to the public in a couple of days. It's just that certain members of the board wanted the right to see it first, and that's where we run into the issue of how public records work.
That's right. And they asked their attorney, Jonathan Vogel, to weigh in on this. And this is what he said in response to Stephanie Walker.
Unless that document is covered by some exception to the public records law, it would be considered a public record that would be disclosed upon a request from the public.
Vogel here is basically confirming that, yeah, once you create the document, it's a public document. Now, the issue here, Rachel, that you covered is that, say, the agenda document is created on a Wednesday, and this is the week before a meeting. And so board members are saying, we would like to see this document as soon as it's created on that Wednesday. But the public wouldn't get to see it until 48 hours before the school board meeting, which is traditionally held on Tuesday, meaning that would be published on Sunday afternoon, which are around 5 p.m., which, by the way, would mean someone from the district would have to work on Sunday afternoon. That means that a public document exists Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, most of Sunday, and the public hasn't gotten a chance to see it. Now, what Vogel is saying is that, yeah, it's a public record that the public could request, but you don't know what you don't know. You don't know the document exists unless you're going to do what we call a fishing expedition or a trawling expedition and just every Wednesday the week before a meeting throw out an incredibly broad and possibly onerous public records request saying, like, give us all the documents that you created over the last week. The point here is that, so say a board member just called you and said, hey, I just read my agenda packet. It's a public record. You should request it. There's nothing illegal about that. You put in your request, and under North Carolina's incredibly vague timeline for fulfilling public records
requests, As promptly as possible,
you would probably not get that document unless the administration really wanted you to have it. There's no guarantee that you would get that document before the board meeting the following week. You know, we usually say 2 weeks is when the worm starts to turn and we're starting to, you know, run up against the spirit of that law. Again, law in North Carolina does not lay out 2 weeks or 30 days or anything like that. So all of this is to say that the way this policy was put together, I'm not a lawyer and I can't tell you that this violates state law. But I can tell you from my experience as a journalist, this seems in no way in keeping with the spirit of public records law, and that's kind of what we reported.
And the original policy says that the public gets the files the same time as the board. So they were in compliance still, right, with public records law, and there's no issue there.
Yeah. Now, I do want to give board member Pat Bradford some credit. She did get back to us, and she tried to explain her thought process. And one of the things she was saying is that, you know, sometimes these are drafts that are going to get corrected or it's incomplete or they'll have to add something as they get it. And also, the government's made up of humans who are humans and they make mistakes. So we're going to find typos and stuff that needs to get cleaned up. And it's not uncommon to see, you know, an updated agenda packet. But none of that means that it's not a public record.
With this whole issue, I called up Brooks Fuller. He is the director of the Open Government Coalition. He's actually going to be leaving that soon to work in D.C. And here he is talking about drafts. Drafts of public documents are public records.
In a appellate court decision from 1992, North Carolina's appeals courts have said very strongly that even draft documents are still subject to the public records laws in North Carolina so that we can see what our government is up to.
And I tell the public all the time, and it's Josh Steins. He's the attorney general right now. He's running for governor, but he put out his open government guide because he would be the one dealing with some of these issues if they ever came to a head, him and his office. So they put out this open government guide in 2019. And in it, it says it's a public file once it's created. And they say that agencies cannot decide when to release that file. They can't decide, oh, this isn't timely, or, oh, this isn't prudent. If it's asked and they have it, and if it's a PDF, you attach it and you click send.
Yeah, I mean, I have dealt with the government on many occasions when they have told me, look, this isn't quite ready for prime time. We're still making changes and we don't want people to overreact or take the wrong impression from this. And that's a discussion that the journalists can have. We have to use our discretion to say, would it be misleading to show the public this half-baked cake, for example, without adding any context. But that is a decision that journalists get to make under the law. That is not a decision that the government gets to make under the law. And the other thing I want to add real quick is that Brooks Fuller is coming at this from the position of the public and from journalists. He is an advocate for transparency from our side of the equation. It's worth noting that if we were to go to court with a local government agency, and this was to work its way up in the courts, Josh Stein would be defending the government. The Attorney General's office represents the government in cases, including cases about public records law. So this is Josh Stein telling the government, as your attorney, please don't make these mistakes because I will have to be the one defending you in court, or my office will have to be defending you in court, and we will lose because this is what the law says.
I thought this was interesting that Brooks said is about the public records law in general.
One really important thing to always remember is that our courts have said over and over again that the public records law should be interpreted broadly in favor of access, and exemptions to the public records law should be interpreted narrowly, again, in favor of access. That is the guiding spirit behind our law, and that's how government officials at all levels should comport themselves.
It's more complicated than just what the law says, because as we've noted on this and many other episodes, is that the law is in place quite vague. You know, there isn't a set timeline. There isn't, with exceptions of things like public records law, some things are left up to interpretation. And so what Brooks Fuller is saying is that the case law, what judges have argued, and really the spirit behind this is that when in doubt, trust the journalists and hand it over.
And Brooks, I asked him because I really wanted to follow up on this elected official thing. Of course, they get preference with confidential information. They get to ask the attorney questions in closed sessions again. They do get to view personnel records of their employees. So they do have a lot of rights that us in the media and us in the public do not have. But if it is a public file or it's an open meeting, there's not a hierarchy there. So this, he was responding to Ms. Bradford's original point about the public should just be elected officials if they want all this access.
That's exactly what the public records and open meetings laws are supposed to do. And that's a good thing. It doesn't become a bad thing to give the public power and information and interest in this system. That actually benefits all of us. It helps prevent and address corruption. It helps people understand who they want to vote for and what public policies they want to get behind. It helps people understand how those policies affect their daily lives.
To go a little further, I talked to him about, we'll see this in the fall, that everybody loves to campaign on transparency and accountability. And I said, it's hard for us to see this play out as journalists each election cycle, that everybody thinks that this is a really good idea, but when they get into office, oh, wait. So your thoughts begin to change sometimes, depending on who you are, about this. And I said, is it just because they're not aligning with what they say with their value system, basically practicing what you preach? But then Brooks said, it's just more than that.
Transparency isn't just a value system. Transparency is the law in North Carolina, unless a document or a group is exempt. It is a system of democratic philosophy and democratic principles that are absolutely critical at all levels of government, but it also is the law. These public officials are required to hand over documents that are public records. And far too often, I think they want those documents to be kept out of public view so that they can just do their business in quiet. Not necessarily because they're trying to be corrupt or secretive, although those things do happen, they just don't want to be bothered. But I'm really here to tell you, like, the essence of democratic systems of government is that the public does get to bother you and does get to voice concerns. And that's a very good thing that we should be protecting.
So I will say that over the years, I have heard from many public officials who were frustrated when something they did or said was taken out of context from a single email. And if you're listening to this, you know who you are. And I say I sympathize with you. And I want to say one more time that, again, this is supposed to be a relationship. We are part of the fourth estate. We are part of how democracy works. It is our job to help and force the government to be transparent and accountable. But when the press takes stuff out of context and maybe finds a salacious looking email and then runs a story and doesn't do the follow-up footwork and add the context, that's incredibly frustrating. It decreases the trust in the press. It frustrates the government, makes them wish, gosh, I wish we didn't have all these public records law and open meetings law. So to some extent, I understand the frustration of public officials who have to do a very difficult job under a microscope. But I think the alternative is way worse. In a world where the government just says, trust us, and we have no way to fact check that, where we cannot trust but verify, then that's a grim scenario. And as Brooks Fuller points out, that's not really the spirit of democracy that we cherish in this country and in this state. And that's why this last note that you talked about with Brooks Fuller is a little frustrating. And here we're talking about a recent change in the law that allows state officials to basically determine what of their own email communications and other communications that they want to be public.
And those state officials are the legislature. These are our House of Representatives, and these are our senators in our state. So what they did was they slipped in a provision in the last budget bill that said that they are the custodians of their own records and they get to decide what they release and what they don't. And they also, they ended the transparency around redistricting records. And so I was at a journalism conference recently with reporters around the state, and the Raleigh News and Observer, I mean, that is basically one of our papers of record for this entire state. They follow the state capitol. They follow all of our state legislators. And they were talking about how devastating that this provision was. I asked the question again, who was responsible for this? And they still don't know. Nobody has taken ownership of this. And so you have to wonder why this was passed if nobody is really proud of owning it. Here is Brooks.
The legislature has indeed reversed a major aspect of the public records law. They've now grabbed hold of the power to decide when their documents are public records and when they're not, and they can make those decisions unilaterally. They don't need to do so through any further legislative action. They can just decide on their own. Each individual member of the General Assembly can decide that for themselves. And it's created quite a mess down there in Raleigh.
So these Raleigh News and Observer journalists actually did a test right after this was passed to see who would actually give over some emails that they asked about. And it was bleak what they reported. It was both parties not giving over files. So this is a tool that is gone for our state journalists that are following our legislature. And it's the same thing with our representatives here, who are Michael Lee, Bill Rabin, Ted Davis, Deb Butler, Frank Eiler, Charlie Miller. But what they did say, the Raleigh News and Observer journalists, they said, hey, you can still get their emails to public agencies. If they're talking to DOT, if they're talking to the Cultural Resources Department, you can get those exchanges. But again, if they're talking to constituents back and forth, that's up to them to release. There's nothing that compels them now.
Constituents and donors. And this is probably a question we're going to be asking our candidates in the fall during the general election, because people make laws, and sometimes those laws are frustrating, but people can change those laws. So it'll definitely be on our docket for questions to ask about. Because one thing I can say is that public records and transparency, it's not a partisan issue. It is a lowercase d Democratic issue. All right, well, that's just about all the time we have. Obviously, we could get all the way down a number of these rabbit holes on the issues of transparency and public records and public meetings. But for now, Rachel Keith, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
All right, well, that's all the time we have for this special Pledge Drive edition of The Newsroom. Thanks to Peter Castagno and Brenna Flanagan from Port City Daily and Zach Solon from WECT, and to both of those outlets for helping us celebrate Sunshine Week, along with my colleagues, Rachel Keith and Kelly Knoyer. And of course, thanks also to our WHQR technical team, Ken Campbell and Mark Brady. If you missed any part of this show, you can find it at whqr.org or as a podcast. If you have ideas for a future show, let us know at newsroom@whqr.org. And one more gentle nudge here at the end, because, of course, it is Pledge Drive Week, and this is a Pledge Drive edition of The Newsroom. If this show is meaningful to you, if the reporting from my colleagues Camille Mojica, Nikolai Mather, Rachel Keith, and Kelly Knoyer is valuable to you, I hope you will go to WHQR this afternoon and make your pledge of support. I'm Ben Schachman, and on behalf of the entire WHQR news team, I say thank you, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.